but that's the old me. Shouting out of my window, throat down, 'cause I don't care anymore. Said I don't care.
Let's go. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you're having a great Saturday. Hope we can make your Saturday even a little bit better. Or, you know, whatever day you're listening, if you're listening to us on the podcast version of this show. Either way, we hope we can make it better for you by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on the show, please welcome from the Pop Culture Knowledge Channel on YouTube, Jeremy Branch.
Hey, glad to be here. I'm always excited to talk about kind of what's going on in the world of pop culture. And we got a stacked coming up next week as well. This week, though, I think we're going to kind of focus down on something that we've been missing the last couple of weeks, and that's House of the Dragon. So we're going to jump into a conversation about that after the first break. But first, Julio, I'm going to pull a Cody Rhodes here. What do you want to talk about?
What do I want to talk about? Well, I mean, I would love to be talking about Alien Romulus, but I haven't had a chance to see it.
Yeah, me neither.
Pleasantly surprised at how good the early reviews are on this movie. Although I do have a friend that saw it and said he thought it stunk, but he doesn't like anything. So
what does he know? No doubt.
Yeah, it's kind of the, you know, it's not an A24 art film. So
Shout out to Phil. We love.
Don't get me wrong. I love A24 art films. I do, but I like a good popcorn flick too. I hate to say I don't quite position myself as a fan of the director Fede Alvarez. Like I respect him. I think he does interesting work. I did really like his Evil Dead remake, which isn't really a remake. It's kind of the same, a similar story, but with completely different characters and a completely different tone. It does not have the comedic tone that the original Evil Dead has. It is much, much more grim and much more of a hardcore horror movie. And it's really well done. And I think it's got some really original ideas. And I think it's brilliantly made. And I am a big fan of, which is not a popular opinion amongst the Evil Dead fan base. I am a big fan of that movie. And I'm a big fan of the Evil Dead franchise in general. But I think it's a great film. You like it too?
Yeah, and I was going to say, I believe I've even said it on air before, but Fede Alvarez is a filmmaker with a very, his movies have a mean streak, a mile wide, and for what they are, they're really, really effective. There's some shots in Don't Breathe that are just masterfully done. I am a fan of him. I even thought Don't Breathe 2 was pretty good, but even watching the trailer for Alien Romulus, I'm just like, oh, okay, this is going to be maybe akin to David Fincher's Alien 3, but dialed up to 11. So I'm excited to see it.
He didn't do Don't Breathe 2, did he?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, that's why Don't Breathe is the reason I'm cautionary about positioning myself as a fan of his, because I really respect that movie from a technical standpoint, from some of the shots, from some of the set pieces that are just incredible, but I freaking hate the movie.
It's a nasty one, but to your real quick.
But you're right about the mean streak.
By the
mean streak is kind of why I have problems with that movie. And I appreciate that mean streak, and I kind of want to see that mean streak in an Alien film, because that's what Alien kind of should be in a sense. But the fact that in that movie, in Don't Breathe, there is just no redeemable character in that movie. Like, every character in that movie is a piece of crap.
Yeah.
The one you're kind of supposed to root for is maybe the least bit of a piece of crap out of all of them. But they're all horrible people, and they all deserve whatever they get coming to them. So,
is it Logan Lerman was a sweet boy? No, who is the kid that was in Scream?
No, there's nobody in that movie that is redeeming. They all have like gross ulterior motives, or they're robbing somebody, or there's the one little kid that she kind of takes care of that I guess is the only one that is, but she's not really in the movie either. She's like at the beginning.
Who among us has never committed home invasion on a blind man? I mean, come on.
I mean,
I'll
raise my hand and say I haven't done that and have no intentions of doing it. So yeah, all I right. mean, but like, if you can kind of marry that mean streak where the mean streak is just coming from, you know, like in this case, if it's an alien film, it's coming from these monstrous alien creatures, then I'm cool with that. Like, and Kaylee Spaney is starring in this. I think she's a fantastic actress. So I'm.
Did you see her in Priscilla?
I did. She's really okay, good in
I've
it.
I've never seen her before.
The movie I'm not overly thrilled with, but her performance is great.
Okay.
The two leads in that movie, the other one is the dude from Saltburn who plays Elvis. Not Barry Keoghan, but the guy he gloms onto. I can't remember his name right now.
But
the two leads are very good in it. The movie I think has some weak points to it, but I watched it fairly recently. Those two performances are great, and then in Civil War, Kaylee Spaney is just amazing.
Oh yeah, so I have seen her. She was very good in Civil War.
Yeah, she is. Her and Kirsten Dunst, as far as I'm concerned, two best female performances of the year so far. So, you know, I would like to see both of them nominated for Oscars for that film. I'd like to see some Oscar nominations for that film, depending on what else we get through the rest of the year. So, yeah, I'm very eager to see what she does. But, you know, lead in Don't Breathe was Jane Levy. I like her. You know?
Yeah, I'm shocked that you didn't like Don't Breathe a little bit more. That was a really, I guess, fun is a word that I would use for it. But it, I understand your criticism.
I really respect a lot of the tension that he ratchets up in that movie. I think some of the set pieces in that movie are absolutely brilliant. But the movie left me wanting to take a shower. And
yeah. Sometimes we just need to take a shower, though.
Can be in a good way, and sometimes it can be in a bad way. Like, it just left a really bad taste in my mouth. And not one that came
Fair
from
enough.
A turkey baster. if you know, you know. Speaking of movies that may have left a bad taste in somebody's mouth, you saw the new Blake Lively movie. What's it called again?
It Ends With Us.
It Ends With Us. Yeah, I keep forgetting the title of this movie. It's based on a Colleen Hoover novel. She's a very, very popular novelist right now. One of the big. But I'm less interested in the movie itself and kind of more interested in the tabloid stuff that's going on around the movie.
Like, yes, it's been an interesting couple of weeks, in particular between the filmmaker himself, who also is the star of the movie, Justin something. I don't have his name in front of me, but he's a first-time director. He worked with Blake Lively, who is a Hollywood heavy. I mean, she is one of the kind of elite Hollywood celebrities, married to Ryan Reynolds. So they did this kind of promotional thing where they wanted to pull a Barbenheimer. They wanted to take Blake's movie and Ryan's movie and kind of marry them into this package deal. And you mentioned that you think it kind of worked, huh?
It did kind of work because this movie is making a ton of money. It came in number two behind Deadpool and Wolverine at the box office for the opening weekend. But like on the dailies, it's actually doing better than Deadpool and Wolverine. So not quite the same thing because Deadpool and Wolverine had already been out for a couple of weeks. But, you know, they've been out promoting each other's movies in the press, and I think it worked because this movie is definitely a certified hit. And you got this guy, Justin Baldoni, who's the director and the star. And you'd think he'd be out there, you know, basking in the glow of his first huge hit movie. He's directed a couple other movies, has been in some other stuff. But, you know, his first big hit movie is the creative mind behind the movie. But he's out hiring crisis PR. Because apparently there may have been some method acting going on in this movie.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't really, you know, put it under my thumb as far as what really happened. It just seems kind of catty differences. But I think the director wanted to kind of emphasize the seriousness of the movie, where I think to general audiences, it was kind of pitched as a rom-com, which it's really a movie about domestic violence and dysfunctional relationships.
Yeah,
and
it didn't look that comedic to me.
Funny.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting. Because that was a big point of contention that I heard, is that Blake and that side of the cast and crew were out kind of promoting it as this fun kind of romance movie. And then on the other side, you've got the director going out and talking about the weight and the gravity of it. And people kind of thought that maybe it was not tactful to hitch its wagon to something like Wolverine and Deadpool, which is so irreverent and I think it just depends on what you want, you know, your movie to do. And for the producer of it, selling tickets is really important. So going out and doing what it takes to sell movie tickets is kind of the name of the game. So I don't fault Blake Lively for her strategy, but it seems to be very much in contrast to what the filmmaker himself wanted to present the movie as.
Well, we'll see where it goes. We've got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
To me.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And I felt like that was an appropriate song to lead into us talking about. We're going to do a deep dive, I think, into season two of House of the Dragon. What's going on with the series? Where it seems like it may be going from here. And some of what the internet is reacting to about this show. Well, now let me just take in the last part first. The internet's always wrong. Sorry.
Part of it.
Internet's always wrong. There is the internet is a very short-term perspective.
Yes.
And it does not wait to take things into their full perspective before it reacts to things.
No, it can't. There's a whole industry built upon just having the fastest hot take possible.
Yeah.
This is very typical.
And to the extent that I wonder if, us coming into this topic, relatively late, because it's been almost 2 weeks since the season finale of House of the Dragon. I wonder whether we're not sometimes waiting too long to discuss some of these things.
This is our retrospective on season two.
And that's fair, but, and I don't think it's a topic that's going to go away in the probably going to be another 2 years before we get another season of the show.
Yeah.
But, and that's its own issue. It is what it is. But,
yep.
I think that's what we're seeing with a lot of these prestige dramas, but that's because, in part, it's because of the demands of the audience. We want these series that bring this, epic big screen cinematic quality to the screen, but we want it as a TV series. You can't turn that around
now.
You can't turn around 24 episodes of that a year, and you can't do that many episodes, and you can't do them that quickly and have that kind of quality. So
no.
Do you want 24 episodes in a year that have the quality of, an 80s action series? Do you want 24 episodes of the A-Team, or do you want 24 episodes of the A-Team every year, or do you want 8 episodes of House of the Dragon every 2 years?
So let's pick up where we left off as far as just kind of catching up to where we end off, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about where we want things to go, and then circle back around to this conversation. Let's give the folks a little bit of context, because I actually have a little bit of, it's generally available, but in insight as to why this was an 8-episode season and how maybe things would have went differently had it had its entire 10 episodes. So I'm going to keep all that stuff in my back pocket, but when is the last time we talked about House of the Dragon?
I think we were at about the halfway point in the season.
Mm.
Now, I'll admit that on a surface level, the first half of the season was probably stronger than the second half of the season.
Okay.
In that I feel like they chose to parcel out several parts of the story in the second half of the season across several episodes, where maybe it might have worked a little better to focus on only one or two characters for an episode instead
of
like,
dive into that a little bit more. Explain that.
Just, you know, you have like these separate storylines going on. Like you've got, and we'll put up the spoiler warning here. You know, if you have not watched all of season two of House of the Dragon yet, we've given you a couple weeks already, but if you haven't, you know, just keep in mind, we're going to be talking about the whole season right now. So if you haven't watched all of season two yet, spoiler warning in effect for House of the Dragon season two. Keep wanting to say Game of Thrones.
That's understandable.
Yeah. And this is a prequel to Game of Thrones. But I also think that's some of where the internet's wrong here. Like, the internet wants to treat this like it's Game of Thrones. It's not the same show. And it does not have the same perspective, and it does not have the same scope. This is, you know, Game of Thrones had this scope that went across, I think, what's supposed to be seven novels, although I think he's only written five of them. And so, yeah, you can get into all of that, but it's this, you know, big span of several novels, and it's this ongoing narrative that really the show had to complete without having a guideline of the books for the last two novels, where this is a single book that is being adapted across one series. And I think you have to really look at this as, you know, we now know they've come out and said four seasons, and that's it. We're doing four seasons of this show. So we know where this show ends. We know where this ends from the books. Even whether you've read the books or not, you know that there is a finite amount of material here. And I think that looking at this like a traditional series is dumb. This is a miniseries. It's a long miniseries. It's a long miniseries, but it's a miniseries. And we're at the end of the second chapter of a four chapter book.
So back to where you were at a moment ago, as far as focusing on characters and maybe where it lagged, what are your thoughts on, for example?
Yeah, okay, so
in this series, we've got a whole lot of Daemon having this character arc while he's in Harrenhal. He is going through a transformation. It's really important that characters kind of evolve throughout the story. So we've got him kind of coming to terms with what his role is in this. We've got the Greens and Aemon seizing control and sort of, you know, becoming this tyrannical leader of the Greens while simultaneously pushing Allison out. And then we've got Rhaenyra kind of cultivating this group of bastard dragon riders to strengthen her army. And those are a couple of the main stories that were kind of exploring throughout season three, but I guess specifically, are we talking about Daemon?
Yeah, well, there's a few other subplots in there. You mentioned a couple of them, but there's the one with Daemon's daughter finding her own dragon. There's the bit with the sea snake and his relationship with, you know, him losing his wife and him having to acknowledge these bastard sons that he has. And where that's all coming in, you know, all of those things where we've seen, like, let's say 5 minutes of each of that in each of the last four episodes. And like, would Daemon's story, for example, have been better served by being one episode where we've spent the majority of that episode with Daemon, and then we move on to that rather than that being parceled across 10 minutes of four episodes?
I think that's an interesting point, and I think so.
Like, is there a way we could have juggled that a little better to where, you know, because I think that the internet's concern here at the end of all of this is that they, again, in Game of Thrones mode, Game of Thrones would have been seventh episode is all talk, eighth episode is all action.
See,
and that's not what happened.
Back against that.
Go ahead.
I feel like penultimate episode is the one where the action reaches its climax, and then we've got the kind of cooling off period as the pieces reassemble on the board to in pursuit of what happens in the following season. So I think structurally, it was pretty true to form with some... that part aside, I gotta, like, generally speaking, I love this show. I don't think it's a secret to anybody. Julio, you and I have talked about it. We're both big fans, but there's this interesting thing where it feels like it's both rushing and kind of spinning its wheels idly at the same time. And despite having spent a lot of time with a lot of these characters, I don't feel like I have the same emotional connection to them as I would like a Robb Stark, even at the end of season two of Game of Thrones, being that it is so expansive in Game of Thrones. Like, you nailed it, man. There's so many different storylines happening at one time. We're ping-ponging between characters that have never even met or interacted with each other, and they don't get a ton of screen time, but there's, like, maximized impact. And I think if I had a critique about House of the Dragon, it just feels like we're simultaneously moving really fast and at the same time not really getting there. What do you think?
I'm trying to put that, you know, I'm going to buy into your fallacy for a minute here and try to put this in terms of the end of season two of Game of Thrones to see where I'm trying to go back to see where I'm, where we were at the end of season two of Game of Thrones.
And I should pull that up as well, because I've said that point a couple times without having any sort of strong evidence of it. I might just be emotionally speaking, but I always feel like, for example, the Battle of Blackwater, I don't feel like that was the finale. I feel like it was the episode before the finale.
No, you're absolutely right. It was. It was the episode before the finale, the penultimate episode of season two. So you're absolutely right about that. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're not even near, at this point, we're not even near the Red Wedding. So, like, we had a lot more time with Robb Stark before you really, I think, started to feel for him. I don't feel like I really felt for, like, Robb Stark by the end of season two. I think by the Red Wedding, yeah. But
yeah, I don't even know why I pulled Robb Stark specifically for that example. I just feel like...
This is at the point where, like, Sansa is still engaged to Joffrey, but then Joffrey sets her aside because he wants to marry Marjorie Tyrell and ally with the Tyrell family. I mean, Shay is still around at this point. She's still, you know, Tyrion and Shay are very much still a couple at this point. Catelyn Stark's still around and this is fairly early in Game of Thrones, so you know. There's still a lot of characters that are not around in, like, season six, you know.
We're, like, patiently going, like, because you're right. Okay, so by the time season two of House of the Dragon ends, a lot of things have happened, a lot of very important and pivotal things. And I might be kind of pulling numbers again. I think the entire Fire and Blood is about 170 pages long. So, to your point, we do have a beginning, middle, and end mapped out, but it's the stuff in between that I think they're hitting and missing.
Let's talk about that a little bit more when we come back. We got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
At black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction, in the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning, death and hatred to mankind.
poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube, and we are wrapping up, we're summing up season two of House of the Dragon and kind of looking a little bit forward to what's going to come in the two seasons we know have left to come. Has been announced House of the Dragon will be a four-season series, so we know we've only got two more seasons of this series coming up. We'll put the spoiler warning back up here. If you have not watched all of season two of House of the Dragon yet, please be aware we will be discussing details of the entire season, but in the last few episodes in particular. So you've had a couple weeks to catch up on it by this point, but just in case, spoiler warning is in effect here. So, you know, we were talking about the perception of this season of House of the Dragon, and I think that there's a perception that, for better or for worse, that like this season should have been, we should have gotten into war this season. You were talking before the break, Jeremy, about the fact that this is a relatively short book that this is based on, as opposed to an entire series of novels that Game of Thrones was based on. I think it's also worth pointing out that the book that this is based on is a history book. Like it's a Westeros history book. So it's a fictional history book, but it's a, you know, it's telling the story not in the time that it's going on, but it's people looking back and telling their version of the history. Just like if I was to write a book about the American Civil War right now,
right?
You know, it would be colored by the perspectives of, you know, all of the stories and criticism that have come in the, you know, 100 and some odd years since the Civil War. That's the perspective that the book version of House of the Dragon has.
And where Game of Thrones, just to throw it in there, would have been written from the perspective of one of the soldiers or maybe one of their wives fighting during the Civil War, where there's point of view characters the event.
Game of Thrones, the novel series Song of Ice and Fire, I don't know if you've read any of them. I've only read about half of the first novel, but in fairness, each chapter is from the perspective of a different character.
So you get a lot of their like internal thoughts and you really understand the characters that way.
Yeah, and main characters, not just like random side characters. Like main, you know, this chapter is Catelyn Stark and this chapter is Arya and this chapter is Joffrey or, you know, whoever. I don't know if they have specifically from those characters' perspectives. I know Catelyn definitely does, but
yeah.
But at any rate, you know, there's not a Hodor chapter or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's not one chapter that just says Hodor, 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 Hodor.
No, that would be awesome.
Yeah, it would, but it would also not be. yeah, so versus this is, you know, kind of, you know, basically a dry historical account that doesn't get into any of the motivations of the characters because it doesn't know the motivations of the characters. And I have
seen
out there the perspective of, this is this adaptation is the real story that we're seeing with the actual motivations and the point of view of the characters that you could not be conveyed in the book. Whether George R. R. Martin feels that way or not may be another story. And there's some rumors out there that Martin's not overly happy with some of the things that have happened in this series as well. But above and beyond that, what the perspective that we're losing here is that this is not the saga that Game of Thrones is. This is the story of one war. And it is the story of one war in depth, from the prehistory of it to how things get bad to how the forces marshal and gather into, as this says in the Black Sabbath song that we started here, generals gather in their masses. That's what this season was. This season is the generals gathering in their masses. And next season is the war. And the perspective that, oh, we should have seen the war break out in the last episode of this season, I think is, again, just fundamentally misunderstanding what this work is and what this world is. And there's been a lot of that. I think there was a lot of fundamental misunderstanding of some of the characters in Game of Thrones, and that is the reason why some people felt the last season or two went off the rails, because I think they weren't paying attention. I think some people watch this show very casually. They, you know, have it on in the background while they're playing around on their phone, or they're answering email, or they're playing, you know, I don't know, Candy Crush or whatever phone app game they're playing right now. Apparently based on the amount of YouTube ads I get for it, maybe it's Marvel Snap. I don't know. They're eating dinner, they're talking to their family, whatever, and they're not paying attention to what's going on in the show. And that's why people didn't see in Game of Thrones that Dany was going mad.
I have to wholeheartedly push back against this, and that's okay. That's just the nature of what we do. But I just now finished The Storm of Swords. You know, I'm heavily invested, and I know there's conversations. What happens is, as fans, we take ownership over it. And even though you and I, maybe both of us, read every single book, we devoured every single page, we're going to have different perspectives about who those characters are, what their motivations were, because there's a lot of nuances in this. But I feel like it's usually the most dedicated fan that is going to give the most backlash. I feel like it was the casuals that started watching Game of Thrones during season 7 and just kind of consumed the whole thing from beginning to end and just were like, I'll take it for what it is. So with Game of Thrones, the showrunners were shackled by not having an ending that they essentially had to create, where House of the Dragon isn't shackled by that. What they're shackled by is having to develop these characters without having that rich perspective that there was in Game of Thrones. And I think they have done an exceptional job at creating fully realized characters. Like, Alicent is portrayed as this very kind of pious and just a flat, there's not characterization in it. So, like, what they've done with Alicent, I think, is incredible. What they've done with so many of these characters, I think, works well. It's just that a byproduct of them having so much creative freedom, I think, is what's creating the rift in the fandom. What do you think about that?
I'm interested to hear a little more about your perspective on this, because I'm not sure. I agree to some extent, and I think there's a concern there that the writers may be afraid to make anybody the villain. They're trying to show this perspective of there's good and bad in everyone, and we want you to, like, I'm torn, because to me, I think that it's been clearly shown the Greens are the ones in the wrong here.
But not Alicent, right?
But she is, because she made bad decisions and then stuck by them.
And this is what I love about the show, is that I think that's so true to life. And Rhaenyra, especially in the last couple episodes, has taken a turn towards something a little more fanatical and something a little more like driven by this prophecy. And while we as the audience know the Song of Ice and Fire and all of that stuff, like, for anybody to take their religious views and use that as a justification for anything that they do is a really dangerous thing.
We don't have any real world examples of that.
No, clearly not.
Yes, we do. Yeah, no, that's a valid point. Now, I mean, it's easy to get into the perspective of, well, we know that Rhaenyra is right, because we know that the prophecy of the Song of Ice and Fire is real. We've seen it already. We've seen Game of Thrones. And there was a bit in this last episode with Daemon's vision that leads directly into Dany. And Dany is
what
a descendant.
Do you think about
that? Dany is a direct descendant of Daemon and Rhaenyra.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is them playing a part in fulfilling this prophecy that we know is going to come to a head in Game of Thrones. So it does become, I guess in a sense, it does become the perspective of, as a fan, if you know all of that, you may be inclined to side with the blacks because you know the blacks are right.
ultimately,
but in that world,
that they're right.
Yeah, but in that world, you're right that it's, you know, they're basing this on their religious convictions, but so are the Greens. The Greens are basing, you know, their piousness and their, you know, oh, it's wrong for you to, you know, have messed around with Kristen Cole or whatever, on their piousness based on their faith in the seven.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Let's talk about that a little bit more when we come back. We've got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. Jeremy, we're getting very metal in this episode.
I love it.
Yeah.
Great choices.
I mean, it just feels right. You know, we're gearing up for war here on House of the Dragon, and that just feels metal. So
yeah, it does.
Before the break, you were talking about the religious perspective here, which I think is something I haven't heard discussed a whole lot here. And I one of the things I like about this series and the way it's being done is it is showing the effect of what is basically a civil war. It's basically a battle between two parts of the same family for control and dominance and whose religion is better than the other. And they're showing that effect on the entire kingdom. Like this is dragging the entire kingdom down with it. And we get to see the perspective of the small folk, as they call them, the peasants, and how it's, you know, they're starving because of it and people are suffering because of it. And Rhaenyra even kind of exploits that and turns the small folk against the Greens.
Which is funny because she's the one that ordered the blockade in the first place. So the people of King's Landing are starving because of Rhaenyra. And then she sends them the gift baskets and is like, hey, look, I'm the omnipotent one. I'm the good guy here, and starts to kind of sway the perspective of the small folks. So like it's complex and it's complicated.
We don't see any real world parallels to this at all.
No.
there's nothing like that going on in our world right now at all, is there? Oh, wait.
We're not
going to get into that. I don't even think that these are like intentional illusions, by the way. I think this is just unfortunately something that has repeated throughout actual history.
It's history, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think you got to remember, too, a lot of Game of Thrones and a lot of George R. R. Martin's world of Westeros is based on actual world history or actual...
Mm-hmm.
You know, Earth history. So, you know, some of this stuff is coming from a historical perspective in that regard too. You would think we'd learn better?
No.
You think we'd learn from history and from art and from, you know, no, we're just stupid and keep doing the same stuff. You know, one day we'll all get better at this, maybe. But I don't have a whole lot of confidence in that. Wow, this took a dark turn all of a sudden. We're talking about this fantasy show that we enjoy for kicks on HBO Max, and or Max or whatever it's
here
called.
Here we
this
are.
Week. What is David Zaslav calling it this week?
This week, yeah, no
Zaz's
kidding.
Zaz's happy
no,
fun
I
time
think he's
out.
Trying to liquidate it.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other conversation. Yeah, so I don't know, Julio. I feel like if Rhaenyra were clearly being portrayed as the hero, which is a criticism, interestingly, because every show needs a protagonist, but there are people that say they're afraid to paint Rhaenyra too dark. Meanwhile, she is bringing all these small folk into the castle at Dragonstone, giving them this lame stump speech about how they're all could potentially be elevated and save the world, and then she leads them all into the dragon, the caves underneath Dragonstone, and gets 99% of them just completely eviscerated by Vermithor, while the guards are fighting to keep everybody in there. It's like she could have done that so many different ways. She could have done it one at a time, maybe avoided a lot of casualties that way. But she, with this sense of righteousness, just decides, hey, we'll just throw them in there and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's that scene in particular is a great point where she brings all of these people that are, you know, basically distant relatives.
Uh-huh.
And locks them in a pit and lets most of them burn.
As she just watches from above, you know, this elevated position where, like, the idea that we get is they want peace for the realm and they want everybody to not suffer under these tyrannical leaders. And obviously somebody like Aemon is very, you know, evil, I guess, for lack of a better word. He's clearly on the side of just F everybody else. This is about preserving our family. But I don't think it's ultimately much different for Rhaenyra, only she does it under the guise of looking out for the common folk. And I feel like that's what's really interesting, and it is a theme that goes all the way back to Game of Thrones, but just essentially that, like, it's the people on top vying for power, this thing that is almost unattainable, and once you do attain it, somebody else is always vying to take it from you, and the people who suffer are the people underneath these regimes. And I think I say all that to say, so the idea that Rhaenyra is being painted as the purely virtuous one, I don't think is accurate. And we saw those two scenes between Alicent and Rhaenyra, which obviously, as we touched on, not in Fire and Blood, but I think they add so much more nuance to the characters and give us a better idea about what they actually wanted and what led them there in the first place.
Well, here's the thing, though. Here's where I will separate Rhaenyra and Aemond. Rhaenyra is doing this, whether she's right or wrong, for what she believes are altruistic purposes. She has been presented with this prophecy that she believes in the War of Ice and Fire, the Song of Ice and Fire, and she is trying to protect everyone from that. So she looks at what she's doing as a sacrifice for a necessary evil for the greater good.
Yeah.
Aemond just wants power. Aemond is this kid who got kicked in the shins a bunch when he was little and is mad at the world and wants to control it because of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're 100% right. And by the way, we're talking about characters. The scene with Kristen Cole, where he's like, the dragons dance and we're but ash beneath their feet. All of our pretty songs and stories are like nothing. I was like, holy crap. That was like the best scene in the entire season. I absolutely loved it. And it made me come around on this character that I've pretty much hated since halfway through season one.
Yeah, it's pretty much the first time you don't hate Kristen Cole ever.
Yeah. Yep.
And you know, don't get me wrong. He's still a giant hypocrite. And that's one of the things that I think is interesting about this world is that I do think in the end, yeah, there's this reluctance to paint people as villains, but that's because in real life, people do things, even when they do bad things, a lot of the times they do them because they're doing what they think is right. And like,
and they think it's right.
That whole, like, everyone's the hero of their own story thing.
Yeah, and even to your point about Kristen Cole being a hypocrite, maybe I'm going to sell myself out to see here, but, like, is that not also a part of being human? Is, like, aren't we all hypocrites at some point, you know?
Yeah, or sometimes we make selfish decisions, or we make, you know, decisions in the name of what you want right now without thinking about, you know, the greater perspective or, you know, I don't want to put it in crude terms, but, you know, in Kristen Cole's case, it can be thinking with the wrong brain.
Yeah. I think that's enough.
To some extent. Yeah. And, you know, those of us who are, well, yeah, I'm going to say those of us who are guys, but that's not even fair because women do it too.
Rhaenyra did it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, real life women do it too. Sometimes they're thinking with the wrong brain as well. You know, the reputation is that guys are more susceptible to it, but I don't necessarily think that's true. And, you know, we all make mistakes in the heat of the moment and, you know, may come to regret them later, may not come to regret them later. But
I think that's kind of why I'm reserving judgment on whether or not season two was good or bad, is because in the heat of the moment, we didn't get that thing that we wanted, that gratification. However, sometimes prolonging that makes it all the better when we do. And you mentioned that season three might all be the war, but that leads me to wonder what season four would be if that were the case. Do we really want two seasons of a nonstop battle? I don't think I do, but moving forward at the pace that we've established so far, I've been so immersed from week to week. I think this is a great show, and to reduce it to, oh, this is a blue ball ending or whatever you want to say about the end of season two, I think is just short-sighted.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Game of Thrones has sometimes shown that the most interesting things that happen in the series are not the big action episodes and the big war episodes. And I think even if we do have a season that is mostly war and there's a lot of action in the next season, that does not mean the story is over with the war ending.
Good point.
If the war ends at the end of season three, which we don't know, you know, we don't know how they're going to adapt the rest of this series across 16 to 20 episodes, however many they're going to end up deciding to do a season. So there is a lot here to come, and that's why I'm kind of like putting aside the whether this was a good season or not, and I think it was a good season, and I still very much enjoyed the show. It needs to be judged in the greater perspective of this as basically a finite miniseries rather than an ongoing series with no definitive end. And so we're at the halfway point of the miniseries. I don't think we can say yet whether the miniseries is overall going to be great or not. But we'll find out. And when we do, we'll talk about it on this show. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.